We're in Pledge Drive at Iowa Public Radio, and that means we're asking you to help support the programming you value. It matters that you make your gift of support right now. Put a few of your dollars behind something you believe in, something we all need. Give at iowapublicradio.org. Thanks.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and January is a great time to make your gardening plans for spring. But if you are not averse to having a box of worms in your house, there's something beneficial you can be doing right now. And you just heard the laugh of Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
Wonderful. Erin Stile is also here with us today, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Hello, Erin.
Hello.
Hi. And Cindy, let's start with you. We are going to talk about worms and we're going to talk about vermicomposting. So let's start with some definitions. What is that?
Vermicomposting is composting with worms. So instead of setting up a compost pile outside, you set up a compost your kitchen scraps in some sort of container, and you constantly add those kind of kitchen scraps to it because there are worms that are eating it and that are pooping and creating this wonderful casting and kind of breaking down these scraps fairly quickly. So it's a faster, very efficient way to get really great compost.
All right. And if you don't want to waste your kitchen scraps, our chickens turn kitchen scraps into fertilizer. But
right.
if you have no other place for your kitchen scraps, this is a great way to make use of them. And right. if you set up a relatively small vermicomposting setup in your house, can you handle all the kitchen scraps?
Absolutely. So I do a couple of things with my students. I have a big kind of Rubbermaid container that I have in my basement, in my house. It's got some air holes on the top, and it's got probably a couple thousand different worms in it. And it can handle, I feed it kitchen scraps a couple of times a week, maybe once a week, and it can handle a lot of the vegetable scraps that we have. My students, I start them out with usually something a little smaller, because there's usually only one, maybe two people in their household. And we start off with a gallon kind of plastic ice cream bucket and half a dozen worms and feed them once a week and with just kitchen scraps. And it usually works out pretty well.
Where do you get your worms?
Well, what we typically use is something called red wigglers or red worms. So you can pick these up at a local bait shop. Sometimes you can find them there or some other kind of local sources as well. You can also order them online. So I typically order them online and they come in the mail. So, which is kind of fun to have this fairly small bag of 1,000 worms that comes to me in the mail. And they're really small. They're red wigglers. They're not, you know, big like night crawlers that you would use in fishing. So they're fairly small worms and they multiply pretty quickly. So 1,000 worms sounds like a lot, but they're not as big as you think.
All right. Well, and you make it sound like there's not a whole lot of upkeep. Tell me a little bit more about what you need to do to keep your worms healthy and also to keep the compost coming.
So if you want to do this indoors, and you want to make sure that it doesn't smell or you don't have any other kind of, you know, issues with it, you're putting it into some sort of plastic container usually, and you can buy these kind of level containers, these with little shelves or drawers, if you want. I'm pretty cheap, so I just stick to a Rubbermaid container. I put a little pea gravel in the bottom so that any excess moisture can kind of collect there. And then I start off my worm bin with layers of shredded paper, a little bit of soil, either potting mix or garden soil if I can get it, some shredded paper again, and another layer of soil. And then I put the worms in that soil layer. The shredded paper becomes kind of a bedding place where they kind of hang out. It also helps keep it a little drier, not too moist. And then I add the kitchen scraps on top. The kitchen scraps that I use are usually fruits and vegetables. I tell my students the worm should be vegan. So we keep it, we keep all kind of dairy products and meats out of the bin because they kind of produce a lot of off odors.
Right.
And yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, that sounds like a good plan. And really, I mean, I know that you keep yours in the basement, but mm-hmm. a lot of people keep these in their kitchen. They really don't right. smell?
They don't smell. They don't smell. If it's maintained properly, if it gets too wet, you need to add some more paper or let it dry out, open it up and let it dry out. Then it can smell a little bit if it's too wet. If you've added in something, you know, like cheese or some kind of dairy, it might smell as well. But, yeah, these usually it doesn't smell. It smells a little bit like soil. Another trick is to really chop up the kitchen scraps pretty finely so that they can be eaten or consumed pretty quickly. That way, like a whole head of cabbage would take forever for the worms to eat, and it might smell if you were to throw, you know, half a head of cabbage
All right,
there.
Small vegan kitchen scraps.
Yeah, small vegan kitchen scraps. Yeah, they have little mouths, so they have to be kind of small. Yeah.
How long does it take for a small box of worms to start really producing the amount of compost that you can use?
Right. So it takes a little while when you start. So it's going to be, you know, a month or 2 months before you actually have something that you can use. And it might just be small bits initially that you could use in potting up houseplants. I generally empty the bin once a year, maybe twice a year. And then I get some nice kind of what they call castings or compost from it that I can add to a raised bed. Or to containers around my house. So I guess it depends on your system. You can harvest the castings more frequently. In this Rubbermaid container that I have, I put a light on top so that the worms go to the bottom because they like the dark, and then I can kind of harvest that compost and the castings from the top layer. Without harvesting the worms.
All right, I was just going to ask that. That sounds maybe a little bit tricky because you don't want to throw your worms out.
Right. There are composting bins that produce these little drawers that have these screens, so you can move the worms from one drawer or shelf to another by which ones you're feeding off of, so that a lower drawer or an upper drawer, you can just harvest the castings and compost from that. Because they're not in there. So you know, worms will follow the food, and they will go to the dark. So those are the two things that you need to remember in trying to harvest that kind of castings and compost.
Now, it sounds to me like this maybe is a good supplement to a larger compost bin that you might have mm-hmm. outside if you have yeah. enough land and enough room for that. How do you use what comes from your vermicompost setup? Do you consider that to be special? Is it even more rich as far as fertilizing goes?
I think so. I think it's a little more rich because there's that worm poop that's in it or castings. So it's usually a slightly better fertilizer than just regular compost, but regular compost, you know, that you do outside, you can usually produce more and you will have a larger quantity, and it's still also fantastic. So you can't go wrong with either one. I just try and use the worm castings that I get in more containers in the spring, maybe my raised bed as well. So it's, yeah, I'm pretty selective as to where I put it.
All right. Well, and we've there are a lot of resources online, including one written by you about vermicomposting. I'll tweet out a link to that here momentarily. But if you don't want to have a box of worms in your kitchen or your basement, or maybe you'd like to do even more than that, of course, you can also compost outside. Erin, are you a vermicomposter, too, or strictly the other kind of composting?
No, just the other kind of composting. I haven't dipped into the box of worms yet. Although it is, I mean, one of the great benefits of vermicomposting is you have something to do with all of your stuff mm-hmm. in the winter. because I can throw this stuff outside on my compost pile in January, but it's not going to do anything until temperatures warm up. So it is a nice way to actively deal with all of those kitchen scraps during the cold months.
Yeah, and you don't have to go outside to deliver them to the compost pile, which is a huge benefit. So, Aaron, for people, I think a lot of people are like, yes, I would like to be composting, but maybe haven't set it up or haven't successfully set up their composting system. So in setting up an outdoor composting system, what are some of the basics?
Well, I think the overriding idea here is that when you pile organic matter, it will decompose. And when we talk about composting, we often are talking about how to be the most efficient composter we can be so that we can get this stuff in 2 or 4 months instead of 6 or a whole growing season. But sometimes that intimidates people. Know that when you walk into this, if you pile up organic matter, you're going to get compost eventually. If you do a good job of balancing brown or carbon-rich materials, things like shredded leaves and straw, and green materials, things like grass clippings and the vegetable pieces that you come from your kitchen, you might get compost faster. If you turn it more often, you'll get compost faster. If you make sure it doesn't dry out, you'll get compost faster. So a 3x3 pile, a mix of green or wet stuff or brown or dry stuff. If it's in smaller pieces, it will break down faster too. You can build a bin, or I honestly just have a pile. I think it's easier to turn it when it's just sitting in a pile. As long as stuff doesn't blow away, it works really well.
All right. So it sounds like you're saying, although you can get super technical with compost, you can also keep it very simple. So if you get intimidated by people talking about the temperature that your compost pile needs to be and all of that stuff, you don't have to work that hard.
Mm-mm. It's if I say it only because I don't want the intimidation factor to prevent you from composting. It is a fantastic way of getting rid of excess organic matter in our gardens. It doesn't go to somewhere else. It doesn't go to a landfill, and it becomes this black gold for your garden that adds organic matter, adds a little bit of fertilizer. It is so good for growing plants. So don't let all of the information like really intimidate you. Just step into it and you can make changes as you go and learn as you go.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me today, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about the plants, trees, or compost in your life. We have been talking about composting so far, but of course, Cindy Haynes and Aaron Stile are here to answer any of your questions. Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. You can call us 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to go to the phones. Bob is on the line in Carlisle. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question involves ground orchids, if they will winter over in Iowa or not. I live outside Des Moines, so I'm not quite sure how hardy they would be to remain in the ground over the winter.
Cindy?
There are some ground orchids, terrestrial orchids, that are hardy. They're native in parts of Iowa. They're part of the prairie, parts of the prairie. It's like anything else. It depends on the species. It depends on the location, and it depends on that they really need that kind of ideal site. Do you know what kind you have or
Well, it is known that they're, right, it's variety K-A-T-Y.
Okay. I don't know.
I don't. Gorder from McClure and Zimmerman, which are located in Wisconsin.
Yep.
I've had it for several years.
Uh-huh.
I grew one of those pot plants and bring them in the wintertime, but I was wondering if they could actually go in the ground as well.
Right. So if you can look at the zone information on what you got, or go to McClure and Zimmerman and look for the hardiness zone information, my guess is if they're terrestrial orchids that are growing outside in Wisconsin, they'll probably grow just fine outside, even in Iowa, over the winter. Many ground orchids will go dormant during the winter, and they have a fairly well-established root system so that they come back year after year. I, of course, would not put them outside now. I would wait until spring, but do a little research and see if they're hardy to zone 5 or 4, then you should be okay. And then also do a little research as to the site. Most of them need, fairly quite a bit of direct light, but maybe not all day sun as well, because they're usually something kind of short.
So the call should be similar to the native lady slippers?
Right. A little bit like the native lady slippers. Some of the terrestrial orchids are found on the edge of a prairie or in a prairie, so they can tolerate a little more light than maybe the lady slippers, which are more kind of a woodland orchid. So it kind of depends on the species. And I don't know the one called Katie. Aaron, do you?
I don't know it either. Of course, there's a lot of different cultivars and species out there. So, yeah.
But the ones I have bloom in the wintertime. When I bring them inside, they don't bloom outside. But when I bring them in the wintertime and they start growing, and then they start blooming in the winter.
Oh, that's awesome. Obviously, that's not what you want to have happen if you plant them outside. So I would say do a little bit of research on this from McClure and Zimmerman. That's a great company, and you're right, they're out of Wisconsin. They'll let you know the hardiness on that one and give you some site specifics. And if you have several of these in containers, I would suggest that you keep one or two in containers so you have it in bloom in the winter, and then plant one or two so you can enjoy those blooms in the summer.
I thought so. I have three. Maybe keep one or two, and then plant one outside as well, and plant close to the foundation so it doesn't freeze solid.
Right. I think that's a great plan. But double check that hardiness zone.
Okay. Well, thank you for all your help.
All right. Yeah. Thanks a lot for your call, Bob. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Mary's on the line in Muscatine. Hi, Mary.
Hey. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
My question is about how much sunlight a person, a pile needs in order to actually break down, because I have lots of trees and shade.
Okay. So, Aaron, how much sunlight does compost need to break down?
The ideal compost pile is in part sun. You want a little bit of sun to help add some heat, and those microbes in there need to do some work. But often compost piles that are in full blaring sun dry out too quickly. So ideally you're somewhere in between shade and sun. But with that said, you'll still get compost in the shade. It might take a little bit longer. It might not get as warm. But if you do some of the other things that help compost move along, like grinding up, shredding the leaves and things like that, making sure that it's about the wetness of a damp sponge at any given time, and turning the pile maybe once a week even, you should be able to kind of offset maybe not having as much sun to get compost in a reasonable amount of time.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot for your call. And here's kind of a follow-up question to that from Sam. There are bins, rotating tubs, piles, and all kinds of methods to create compost. What is the fastest way to go from typical lawn and garden waste to good quality compost?
Well, I would say, one of the tried and true methods is kind of the 3-bin system. And the reason why this can work well is because you basically are creating batches that can have a good mixture of that green And brown materials, so the stuff that's high in nitrogen, things like coffee grounds and kitchen scraps and stuff that's high in carbon, things like straw and newspaper, shredded leaves, those kinds of things. You can create like these little batches and then they can break down and you just transfer them from bin to bin. As they maybe every month or two as they're breaking down. So the first bin can be used to be gathering things. Then you transfer it after 4 or 6 weeks to the second bin, which is where it can do a lot of its work. And then you transfer it again to the third bin when it's almost finished. And meanwhile, you can still be starting a new pile in that first bin. And so a lot of people see success with that. If you're constantly adding new material to your compost pile, it's going to be really hard to get to a pile that's completely done because there's always going to be something new in it. So having these kind of little batches works really well for a lot of gardeners.
All right, let's go back to worms. Sam is on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Sam.
Hello, can you hear me clearly?
Yeah, what would you like to talk about?
Okay, so I've been studying earthworms for many, many decades, and a good friend in Brazil came up with a really nice way of doing vermicomposting using two bins, like the tubs that were talked about earlier, where mm-hmm. you put some fairly good-sized holes in, like, the diameter of a penny in the bottom of the bin, and then you put in the layers, as was previously described, and you add the kitchen scraps, as mentioned. But as that tub fills up, you then put your second tub on top of that, also with holes in the bottom, and then you start adding, then you build new layers in the second tub, and the worms follow the food. They'll come up right through the holes and into the second tub and then start eating there. And then you can pretty much harvest the whole compost of the bin below en masse, and you don't have to pick worms up.
It's a great idea. It's a great idea. And it's a lot like the shelving system that you can get or you can purchase. These kind of vermicomposting systems that have different shelves with different holes and screens that the worms can move through the different layers. But it's a lot less expensive with the two-bin system that you described. Great idea. I think it will work great.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Sam. We've got another suggestion. This one's from Brenda and it has a great phrase in it. So brace yourself. Brenda writes, a really great way to do this is to have two Rubbermaid bins, drill holes in the top one with the worms and compost, but clean soup cans in the bottom bin to set the top bin higher. This way, a very rich worm tea will drip to the bottom bin, and that is excellent for feeding plants. I've done this for years. That is a great tip, but worm tea definitely takes the cake.
That's... Worm tea and compost tea are very popular. Yeah, this is good.
Do not drink them.
No, do not drink that tea.
All right. And yet another follow-up question about the vermiculture. Kay wants to know, she says, how do you deal with stems? In both my worm bin and especially compost, stemmy material never decompose. Do you chop or shred your garden debris? Also, brown dry stuff is hard to come by for worms in the winter. Do you use newspaper? So, Cindy, let's start with shredding and stems.
Right, shredding and stems. So the smaller you can make things, the easier it will be. I generally don't put any twig type debris in the worm bin. It's just too hard. Sometimes they even have a hard time with orange peels or grapefruit peels if I'm not chopping it up small enough. So, yeah, so whatever you're putting in there, if it's very woody or very thick, you need to kind of chop it up into smaller bits so that they can access it and degrade it a little bit faster. And then as far as the shredded kind of carbon material, I add shredded paper. And I usually have shredded newspaper or just shredded Xerox paper from here at work and add that to the worm bin for aeration, for bedding, and it's also something that they can use and eat and add, absorbs excess moisture as well.
It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can join the conversation with your question at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Myra is on the line next with a question. Hi, Myra.
Hi. Hey, I have been being a lazy composter, I guess. So I have a kitchen, like a little ice cream tub in my kitchen where I dump coffee grounds and peelings, et cetera. And I just throw those buckets, you know, into my bin for the city to pick up with. And I'm just wondering, is it worth my while to do that? Is it going to some kind of a process that the city provides to create a composting system? And if so, where can I benefit from the products that the city maybe has using the items that I'm throwing in my bin?
Aaron?
Most municipalities are absolutely composting the materials that you're throwing in a yard cart or a yard bin that you might get from your city. And it usually is pretty good compost. The really large composting facilities like a city might have are usually hotter and bigger. So they don't have like the potential for weed seeds or bad insects or those kinds of things, because they do get quite warm because they're such big and well-managed kind of processes. If you want it back, I mean, the city usually makes the compost available. Sometimes it's free. You usually have to pay a little bit for it. And so you would just have to contact whoever's kind of in charge of the waste, whether that's a company or the municipality, and ask about where you can purchase the compost that comes from all the yard waste they pick up.
Well, good. Then I'll keep doing it. Thank you for your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Myra. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Ann is on the line next in Waverly. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
The last week I've been trying to put together my feed orders, and twice I have come across websites that have closed down their acceptance of orders because of staffing shortages and feed shortages. So I'm wondering if any of your guests can speak to, I mean, that area. Is there going to be a seed shortage? Should I settle for what I can get, or is it just a COVID delay and I can hold out and wait for the breeds I want?
Cindy, what you want to take that one first, and then Aaron can chime in?
Sure. So we saw a little bit of this last year because of just the overwhelming response and people in wanting seed. So, and because a lot of the seed companies, while they may not have necessarily a shortage of seed, they are limiting the number of employees that can process the seed or ship them out. So I would think that at this early in the game, it just may be a delay in what you can get. Yeah, you just have to wait. You have to wait and see. There's always some seed that will be out of stock because of some crop failure. That's pretty common, but I would say we don't necessarily have a seed shortage as much as we might have a labor shortage because of the pandemic. All right. Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah, I was just going to say it's not uncommon for certain varieties or some plants or seeds that are normally available to not be available anymore, either because they're super popular or because of a failure or something, a crop failure or something like that. I do know that a lot more people are interested in doing that, growing things and starting things from seed this year. So there probably is a slightly higher demand. I don't anticipate us being, I mean, you'll find a tomato. It may not be your first choice. It might be your second choice. But even on a good year, sometimes I have to do my second choice tomato. So,
All right. Ann, thanks so much for the question. It will be interesting to see how the spring goes. Joe is on the line next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a question on clematis plants. I planted a couple of clematis last spring. And I kind of delayed looking into this, but I'm curious what to do with them now in the next spring. Do I cut them down to the ground, or do I let them grow off the die-off? Or what do you suggest there?
Cindy, you want to tackle that?
Sure. Most clematis usually grow on new growth, and we can prune them back in the winter months. What I generally suggest is that you wait maybe until
late winter, early spring to see what starts to bud out. Because you often will get some buds near the base, and I don't like totally cutting it back to the ground. So I might cut half of it back, depending on how much new growth or buds are starting to emerge, and then kind of clean it up that way. And then, of course, with any clematis or vine, make sure that it's what you've left has some structure that it can climb on, and you've kind of slightly attached it to that structure so that it's got a clean structure with no dead debris, as well as it's somewhat affixed, so it's not flopping all over the place.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Joe. We are going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment, and we'd love to answer your questions. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day, and with me, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants, trees, compost, seeds. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. We've got a couple of lines open for you right now, so you can get right on. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. With me, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. And it feels like this time of year, I'm normally asking you guys about it being so cold for so long that could this be a problem for plants? Or it's been, you know, warm and melting, and could this be a problem for plants? Aaron, so far we've had sort of an ideal winter all around. Fingers crossed that lasts. But I mean, this sort of winter is perfect for plants, right?
It is. The most of the state still has a relatively consistent snow cover, and that makes a big difference. That blanket can really help protect, especially a lot of our herbaceous perennial plants. So as long as you're protecting those woody plants from browsing rabbits and deer, and we have this good snow cover, most of those plants will take whatever Mother Nature throws at them the next couple of months.
Well, and we haven't had any big thaws. Of course, we may still have some big thaws coming our way. But Cindy, it's also a great time if the weather's decent. We haven't had a lot of wind even to get out and prune your oak trees. I mean, things are dormant, and this is a good time for that, right?
It is a good time to get out. And if you can find a sunny day that's, you know, not really wind chilled, super cold, this is a good time to get out and take a look at that, because you can see the structure of these trees. You can see what needs to be removed. And we have no fear that there is an insect that's flying around that might spread something like oak wilt or other things. So great time to do some pruning. And then those prunings can sometimes be used as firewood. So maybe not in this year, but next year. So you can have, you know, something else to keep you warm later on.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Tammy is on the line in Urbandale. Hi, Tammy.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I am concerned about the chemicals. Like, people spray their yards, you know, with chemicals to prevent weeds. Now, would those grass clippings then transfer those chemicals into your compost?
All right, if you're using like a
plants or garden.
Right, if you're using a city compost. Aaron, what do you think about that? We know that you can't control everything that goes into a large communal compost.
Right. Most, if not nearly all, of those things are destroyed in the composting process, especially in a large facility where they can get temperatures up really high and they have good ratios and are managing it quite well. Even in our home compost piles, typically low amounts of herbicide that might be on things like grass clippings, if added to the compost pile, break down and are not an issue in the compost pile. If you're in your own personal one, if you're concerned about it, you can always avoid using maybe the first or second mowing on your compost pile. But by and large, that stuff does break down in compost, whether it's at a municipal facility or in your own yard.
All right. Good news. Tammy, thank you so much for the call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Wilbur is on the line in Sioux City. Hi, Wilbur.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
Planting tomatoes from seed. About when could I do that in the spring?
All right.
Either straight in the ground or in a container.
All right. I'll let you tackle that one, Cindy. We're getting itchy to plant even now.
I know. Anyway, I'm going to tell Wilbur to hang on for a little while longer. Tomatoes do require sometimes about 8 weeks, you know, anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks from germination till they're ready and big enough to be transplanted outside. So if you can hold off until late February, early March, usually that's a better time. Because even in Sioux City, you're not going to want to plant these out until early May. At the earliest, probably mid-May would be better. So I would say if you're planting them out in mid-May, then I would start the seed sometime in March or mid-March. Now, early March or mid-March.
I know that we do not typically direct sow tomatoes, although we occasionally have a volunteer tomato plant that shows up from our compost, that kind of thing. But that was the second part of his question. Can he direct sow these seeds?
Well, and I have had some people that do that. It's a little harder to do because you're going to have to sow way more seed than, you know, if you were to transplant, sow them indoors and then transplant them, because you'll have to do a little bit of thinning and maybe only half of them actually come up. And if you direct sow, then I'm going to tell you, you're probably not going to want to direct sow until mid to late April, because it only takes a few weeks for those to germinate, and then you're going to have to train one to become what you want it to be. So late April would probably be the earliest that I would do direct sowing of a warm season crop like tomato in Sioux City.
All right. And you're going to have to wait a long time to get your tomatoes that way, too.
Yep.
So if you wait till Mother's Day and you plant a transplant, whether you've grown it yourself or you buy it, that's probably recommended, right?
Yeah, it is probably recommended. It's a faster start, and you often get a faster harvest as well, or tomatoes faster that way.
All right, let's go next to Bill in Independence. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question on strawberries. I usually try to cover them. This year I didn't get it done. I have 6 inches of snow on them now. I know you can't predict what the weather's going to be like, but whether I should try to come back and cover those with corn stalks or straw.
Aaron?
I think it would probably help a little bit. I'm not sure it would help as much as we would hope, but having a little bit of a blanket would help. It's likely, you know, most of the time the damage happens early or late. So the buds are, you know, late in the spring, they're kind of pulled out of dormancy because it gets really warm for a week or two, and then it crashes back down again. And what the mulch does is help temper that. And so if you can add it, it probably would help a little bit. Of course, it would have been better to do it in the fall to help avoid any of those things that may have happened in the fall. But I think it would help. It would probably be worth the effort.
Is it still better to wait until they have a good hard freeze before you cover them the first time?
It usually is good to wait until it gets nice and cold, because the other thing you don't want to do is to prevent those plants from naturally going dormant. And sometimes if you put mulch on too early, it can basically insulate them too much. And then when it gets really cold, they're not ready yet. So yeah, that timing is still is still good.
Okay. Well, I'll try to get a little cover of something on, and if I don't get it when the snow is gone, maybe cover them lightly then to protect them from the spring.
Yeah.
All right, Bill. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Nita is up next in Waterloo with a question for you, Cindy. Hi, Nita.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for taking my call. I've tried composting worms before, and I didn't have very good luck. And I'm just wondering, is there a good temperature for them? I had them in a cold basement.
Well, in a cold basement is fine as long as it, you know, temperature stays above like 50, 55 degrees. That's okay. They're just not as fast when it's, you know, cold. My basement is around that 60 degree mark, and that's usually ideal. In the summer, I even put it in the garage where it stays below 80 or 85 degrees. So somewhere in that range of 60 to 80 is probably best. And that's one of the disadvantages of having worms, is that you can't put them outside. You can't do that bin over the winter. You have to almost bring them in. And so 55 is probably okay. If you think it's too cold and they're not, you know, consuming things fast enough, then maybe think about moving the bin to a slightly warmer location, like underneath the kitchen sink, because it shouldn't smell at all.
Okay, what's the maximum temperature you want to keep them?
Generally below 80 or 85 degrees. After about 85 degrees, they're, you know, that usually a Rubbermaid or plastic bin is going to get a little too hot for them, and they don't have a really good way to kind of cool down. So
okay.
Below 85, 80, yeah.
All right, and also I've had them, I think, winter over in my garden. They said they wouldn't live through the winters here, but I find them out in my garden.
Right. There are a lot of native kind of are naturalized worms that you will find in your garden. Sometimes you'll even find red wigglers or other things, other types of worms. I think we have some invasive ones now as well. They usually go pretty deep during the winter, so they're a little more protected. And if there's good kind of organic matter, you might see them again next spring. So red wigglers are pretty common. That's why I don't worry so much about having that particular type of worm in a vermicomposting system.
All right, Nita, thanks so much for your call and good luck. We've got another vermicomposting question from Ed in Cedar Rapids. Cindy, can you use coffee grounds in vermicompost?
Absolutely. Coffee grounds and tea, they both work really well.
Drink them once they've been processed again, right?
Yeah, no worm tea from that one as well. But yeah, and I don't think we have caffeinated worms. It works really well. So, and that's a perfect size.
All right, do you have to? Some people produce a whole lot of coffee grounds. Can you go over the top? Can there be too much?
Yeah, you probably can, because coffee grounds are really wet. So I would kind of meter that out and say, okay, these sets of worms, I'm only going to feed them coffee grounds a couple of times a week, maybe three times a week from the coffee pot. The rest is going to go into the compost pile.
All right. We still have time for a few more questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Judge is on the line in Fort Dodge. Hi, Judge.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, when is it time to trim oak trees?
All right, Aaron.
The best time to do that is actually right now. We typically want the plants to be dormant, but we want to do it earlier than other trees because of the risk of oak wilt being transferred. So the typical window is from December to about February is what's recommended.
All right. So he can pick a nice day, even if it gets quite warm on one of these winter days. That doesn't put you
yes.
at risk. You can get out there and
no.
get it done. All right, Judge, thanks so much for the call. 866-780-9100. Paul is on the line in South English, and this is a departmental question. So this one goes to you, Cindy. Hi, Paul.
Okay. Yeah, hi. My question is there still a horticulture phone hotline available?
Right. Now, the horticulture hotline is no longer available. Richard Giron, who was on the show, retired.
Yeah.
So that is one of the things that retired with him. So really the only way to get your answers, your gardening questions answered on the phone is to call IPR on Friday, just what you did.
Okay. Okay. But is there an online service?
There is. We have a series of FAQs that are available on the Hort and Home Pest news page. So you can search some of those FAQs. The Hort line online emails are still being directed to a couple of people here in the department. Though I will tell you that we're not as good and as efficient or as quick as Richard was in answering that, because that was another thing that Richard did and did so well.
Paul, thanks so much for the call and the question. I know nobody likes the answer to that one
right
now.
No.
Don is on the line next in Waukee. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I ordered garden seeds last year from a famous company, and two different things that I ordered said they were one thing and they turned out to be the other thing. The one was snap peas, which were supposed to be regular snap peas, and they grew into flat peas, you know, sweet peas. And one was a variety of cucumbers, which were supposed to be one variety, and they grew into a completely different variety. And I called the company, and they just really weren't much help. They couldn't offer me an explanation for why that was.
Aaron?
Yeah, it may be just as simple as somebody grabbed the wrong batch and filled the wrong seed packets. You know, of course, right. Although its seed looks very similar, and it's quite unfortunate. I think it probably means, for me, it would mean I'd find a different source.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, Don, thanks for the call, and we'll slip in one more call here. Pam in Scott County. Briefly, Pam, what's your question?
Oh, raspberries. I have raspberries in my yard for years. I have some kind of blight of some sort. I'm not sure if it's fire blight is what one person suggested, which I know is not good, or some other kind of blight. They leaf out fine in the spring. They've been in the same location a while. But then as the berries should be plumping up and looking good, they start to dry up and shrink into little odd-shaped seed balls.
Hmm. All right, Cindy.
Yeah, that sounds raspberries are really important, and since we're almost out of time, I think the important thing to remember here is when this starts, you might want to send in a sample or some pictures to the plant and insect diagnostic clinic, because this could be a fungal or maybe a viral or a problem, and we want to identify it and see how it can best be prevented. I think it's also important with raspberries, depending on the type of raspberries that you have, that you do the proper cultural practices, the proper pruning, whether it's the prune everything back in March or just remove the floricanes after fruiting and do some other thinning and pruning in the spring, because that helps create better air circulation in the raspberry patch so that you have less disease problems on some of them as well.
All right, Pam, I know we saved a complicated question for last. If you put Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic, Iowa State University, into your search engine, you'll find how to contact them easily.
That's a good idea.
Good luck with that. Cindy Haynes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Aaron Stile, thank you.
You're welcome.
Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. This is Talk of Iowa.